All right, let's say something now about the Mauritanian fragment. Of course, F.F. Bruce dates this, with most people, to the 2nd century. This is an important list because it, if it's a 2nd century document, is the earliest list of canonical books. It's actually expressly designed to list canonical books. It does exclude, at least by name, the book of Hebrews. That could either be caused by the fact that it was controversial because it was used by the Montanists, or it could be included in the Pauline epistles. There are different reasons for that. As Bruce, I think, does say in his book, there is some controversy created by Albert Sundberg as to the dating of this document, and this has been increased by the work of Geoffrey Hahnemann. I want to just refer to some of Hahnemann's work, not to bore the pants off you, but just to tell you what's going on and what he makes of his conclusions. Hahnemann follows Sundberg and dates the Mauritanian canon back in the 4th century. He does this for a number of reasons. First of all, he believes an examination of the historical evidence that there is no evidence of canonical lists before the time of Eusebius in the 4th century. He says that the fact that Eusebius had to, he uses the word, create a canonical list for Irenaeus and the Alexandrians means that they weren't extant at that time. The church just hadn't thought about them. The fact that all of the canon lists, really, that we know that are expressly canon lists are from the 4th century and not earlier speaks to that, and that's another reason why the Mauritanian fragment should be dated in the 4th century. That sounds a bit like special pleading, but he does put together a pretty strong case. The fact that there is a seeming agreement among the early codices, Vaticanus, Sinaiticus, Alexandrinus, and even the Syriac Peshitta, of a core of New Testament books, now not of a unanimous agreement, we know that Codex Sinaiticus and Alexandrinus do include some apocryphal books within them. Again, these are 4th and 5th century documents, and so, you know, the conclusion is, by Hahnemann and other people, that when you just look at the church history, things start to develop in the 4th century as far as closing of the canon is concerned. Before that, there was some basic agreements and core agreement, but nothing really happened to do anything about it. Now, against that, you have the view of people like Everett Ferguson, who have argued against this position and accept the traditional date of the Mauritanian fragment as a 2nd century document because, for example, its apology for the Gospel of John, which fits much better into a 2nd century environment than it does a 4th century environment. Other reasons for that. But my point here is that if you date the Mauritanian fragment with these scholars like Sundberg and Hahnemann, then it does affect the way that you look at the development and formation of the New Testament canon, because their interpretation based on this 4th century dating is that nothing much was going on as far as canonization in the first 3.5 centuries. If you accept a 2nd century dating with Everett Ferguson and F.F. Bruce and other people, then of course you have a good example of a very early participation of the post-apostolic church in ratifying and identifying the canonical documents. So you can see that there's some importance there in which position you take. And be aware of that if you go on and study this subject in more depth, that there is this issue over the Mauritanian fragment that does affect your interpretation of the church's canon. Moving then from the Mauritanian fragment, let's look at Eusebius's words about this. Here I'm quoting from the translation by Everett Kalin in the Canon Debate, page 390. I'll try and read it nice and clearly to you. Here's Eusebius and what he says. It is reasonable to sum up here the writings of the New Testament that have been mentioned. First place must be given to the holy tetrad of the Gospels, followed by the Acts of the Apostles. Next, one must list the epistles of Paul. After them, the so-called first epistle of John must be recognized, as well as the epistle of Peter. Following these, one must put the revelation of John. We shall set forth the opinions about this book in due time. Eusebius is going to talk about Dionysius's questioning of it. These then belong to the accepted writings. Among the disputed writings that are nevertheless familiar to the majority, there is extant the epistle said to be by James, that of Jude, the second epistle of Peter, and the so-called second and third epistles of John, whether these are by the evangelist or by someone else by the same name. Among the spurious writings must also be counted the Acts of Paul, the so-called shepherd, that's of Hermas, the revelation of Peter, and in addition the so-called Epistle of Barnabas, and the work known as the Teachings of the Apostles, which is the Didache. And moreover, as I said, and this is when he gets to the Apocalypse, the revelation of John, if this should seem to be the right place for it. For some, as I said, reject it as spurious, while others reckon it among the accepted writings. Now, some have also counted among these writings the Gospel according to the Hebrews, which is especially favoured by the Hebrews who have accepted Christ. But you can see what Eusebius is doing, and this, by the way, is all found in his Ecclesiastical History, Book 3, Chapter 25. What Eusebius is doing is that he is clearly identifying the books that we now know as our canon. Hebrews is not included, but would be included in the epistles of Paul. And he's excluding those books that we know are apocryphal. Now, he does mention the revelation of John. He does put it in the canonical writings, but then he does say that some question it and put it among the spurious writings a bit later on. Again, that's thanks to Dionysius. So here's Eusebius, that's what he says about the canon. Now, a little further on, we have Athanasius, and Athanasius will go on and say what those books are. They are in his Festal letter, his Easter letter, where he delineates the 27 books, and he calls them canonical. And I'm going to read to you what Athanasius said in his 39th Festal letter announcing the date of Easter in AD 367. He says this, quote, "Again, we must not hesitate to name the books of the New Testament. They are as follows: four Gospels, according to Matthew, according to Mark, according to Luke, according to John. Then after these, the Acts of the Apostles and the seven so-called Catholic Epistles of the Apostles as follows: one of James, two of Peter, three of John, and after these, one of Jude. Next to these are 14 Epistles of the Apostle Paul, written in order as follows: first to the Romans, then two to the Corinthians, and after these to the Galatians, and next that of the Ephesians, then to the Philippians, then to the Colossians, and two to the Thessalonians, and that to the Hebrews. Next are two to Timothy, one to Titus, and the last one to Philemon. Moreover, John's Apocalypse. These are the springs of salvation, so that one who is thirsty may be satisfied with the oracles which are in them. In these alone is the teaching of true religion proclaimed as good news. Let no one add to these or take anything from them. For concerning these our Lord confounded the Sadducees, when he said, 'You are wrong because you do not know the Scriptures.' And he reproved the Jews, saying, 'You search the Scriptures, because it is they that bear witness to me.' But for the sake of greater accuracy, I must needs, as I write, add this: there are other books outside these, which are not indeed included in the canon, but have been appointed from the time of the fathers to be read to those who are recent converts to our company and wish to be instructed in the word of the true religion. These are the so-called teaching of the apostles and the shepherd. But while the former are included in the canon and the latter are read in church, no mention is to be made of the apocryphal works. They are the invention of heretics, who write according to their own will and gratuitously assign and add to them dates so that, offering them as ancient writings, they may have an excuse for leading the simple astray." That's in F.F. Bruce, the Canon of Scripture, 208 and 209. So Athanasius is very clear, isn't he? He's got the 27 books, he delineates them as being canonical. He says that the Didache and the Shepherd of Hermas are appointed to be read, that they are not canonical, but they are instructive. And then there are a whole raft there of books that he calls apocryphal and misleading. So he's very clear on that, 367 AD. He's the first guy to actually say these are the books and these aren't the books. But of course in our studies, I hope that what I've shown is that God is in control of this process, one, and then secondly, people understood and recognized these books when they met them, and for the most part they excluded the false ones after reading them just through once. They're very easy to exclude. They don't line up with the doctrine of the New Testament and often say silly things. So that's where we're at as far as the post-apostolic witness is concerned. All right, we move on to looking at the criteria of canonicity that was used by the post-apostolic church. Again, let me emphasize, this criteria was used by the non-inspired post-apostolic church to recognize the good from the bad. This does not change the fact that God had already decided what was going to be included in the canon, and that that was going to come through, even through faltering human instruments. And we've got to see both of those things in play. What were the criteria then? Well, most scholars, even of the conservative brand, recognize three general ones. The first one is apostolicity. The question of whether the document was authored by an apostle or by an accomplice of the apostle, or companion of the apostle, if you like. Luke and Mark and Jude are not apostles, but Jude was the brother of the Lord and was known to the apostles. Luke was certainly the traveling companion of Paul and would have known some of the others and met them. And Mark, it seems, was the companion not only of Paul, but also of Peter. And so there are strong connections there. There is also, of course, the connection that they have as far as the apostolic agreement that there is between the writings themselves. There is a continuity, a unity that is seen in the New Testament. There is a continuity also, unity with the Old Testament in its references to the Old Testament. Marcion and many of the Gnostics as well didn't make use of the Old Testament, but of course the Gospels and the Epistles do, and do so frequently. So we have that, the apostolic stamp of approval, a continuity, if you want to make that a separate one, with the Old Testament and among the books themselves. Along with this criteria of apostolic authorship is the fact that all of the apocryphal books, apart from the first epistle of Clement, if it was written by him, and maybe the Didache, maybe the Shepherd, and the epistle of Barnabas, all of these post-date the apostolic times, the first century. And the apostles were dead, they were gone, they couldn't put their sanction on any writings, and so it was deemed appropriate for any writing that was written after the time of the apostles to be considered inferior and non-canonical. So that was another criteria. When was it written? Doctrinal soundness was another criteria. You know, even though some people did think that certain epistles of Ignatius were inspired, and the Shepherd of Hermas, and even the Didache were inspired, it didn't take very long to see that these were inferior to the Gospels and the Epistles in their grasp of the Gospel and their understanding of theology. Also some of the nonsense statements that they made. And so they were excluded early on, and only a few people would embrace them as inspired anyway. And that has to be understood. So these are the main criteria. Was it written by an apostle or a companion of the apostle? Was there continuity between the New Testament books and also between that book and the Old Testament? Was there an early enough date to constitute it being canonical and written by an apostle or somebody under the gaze of an apostle? And then also, was there theological soundness as well? These are the main criteria that were used. These are the ones that are agreed upon. Bruce does talk about some other ones. He talks about Catholicity. But these can basically be included under the umbrella of the ones that I've given you. Those are the criteria that we use. They're simple, they're straightforward. You don't have to be a brain surgeon to figure them out. And they were adequate enough to distinguish the true from the false. It is true that people like, the Gnostics, Valentinus and Basilides, you know, these people often would connect their works to a supposed companion of an apostle. Valentinus invented a guy called Thudas, who he said was around with Paul. Basilides with some other guys who he said hung around Peter. But, you know, there is no history to these guys. Nobody knew who they were. Remember that Basilides and Valentinus were writing well into the 2nd century and therefore had no basis for what they were saying. The issue of the Roman Catholic canon, of course, surfaces. What is it with the Roman Catholics? Why can't they identify the 27 books? If I'm saying that exclusion of the apocryphal books is easy, even on the basis of these simple criteria, then why can't the Roman Catholic Church get it right? Well, it can't get it right because it doesn't view the scriptures as the sole authority. It views the church as the main authority. The church is the one that interprets the scriptures, and there are certain teachings in the apocryphal books which fit very well into Roman Catholic dogma. They really don't want to exclude the Epistle of Barnabas that encourages purgatory, and also the First Maccabees does that in the Old Testament. They don't want to exclude those that would highlight the bishopric and with teachings of baptism and all the rest of the nonsense that you find in the apocryphal literature. You know, they've got reasons for holding some of these other books as canonical. They can see the differences as well as anybody else, but they have reasons of their own for retaining them. They also have the Council of Trent and its imprimatur that is the most important council in Roman Catholic history, and that said that the apocryphal books, the ones that they named, were part of the New Testament canon. So the Roman Catholic Church has always had problems internally as far as its politics are concerned and its history, and also its doctrine, which is certainly not Christian. And then externally it's had problems because of its acceptance of some of the councils of the church and so on. So that's enough about the Roman Catholic canon. I really don't want to go into it an awful lot. Read Bruce on it and some other authors. There's no need with these lectures to go into that at this stage. The Reformation is an issue. Luther, well, didn't Luther say that James was a right story epistle and I will light my fire with it one of these days? Didn't he have problems with the book of Revelation, and didn't Calvin have problems with it? Yeah, they did. They did. There were certain books that Luther thought were not on a par with other books. Hebrews was another one. But these are just men. Okay, these are men and they have failings. Luther never said that James was not inspired, he just couldn't get on with it. And being the kind of guy Luther was, that was the language that he used. Calvin, likewise, he never wrote a commentary on the book of Revelation because he straightforwardly said, I don't understand it. He wondered about it, but never said that it should be excluded from the canon. These reformers didn't believe it was their job to change what Athanasius, for example, had accepted. They did believe it was their job to exclude the Roman Catholic Apocrypha. But again, it was very easy to do that. It was very easy to show why those should be excluded. And so there isn't really an issue there. When you come into the Enlightenment and out of the Reformation days, you come to Jacob Salomo Semler in the 18th century. And Semler is the one who really opened up the can of worms. He's the one who was a rationalist, child of the Enlightenment, somebody who believed that there was no inspiration to start with. You can mess around with the canon as much as you wanted to. And he was the one who wrote the book that really started to give historical criticism its impetus as far as canon studies is concerned. And it's continued until this day. Semler believed that, of course, the church is the one who created the canon, and therefore the canon had no divine authority and should be reconsidered for his day and for a future day. There are some people that hold that view. We've met one of them earlier, Philip Davies, of the University of Sheffield holds that view. But Davies and his ilk, I mean, they are, as far as their abilities are concerned, they are brilliant. As far as their scholarship and their use of those abilities are concerned, they're rubbish. That's been proven by Kenneth Kitchen, for example, in his book on the reliability of the Old Testament, and Proven, Longman and Long, if I've got that the right way around, on their biblical history of Israel and the Old Testament. Davies is an Old Testament scholar, and so they have shown him up to be the bad scholar that he is, but he does write on New Testament canon as well, and he is to be treated in the same way. Believers deal with the canon in one way, unbelievers will do what they want anyway, won't they? And Davies is one of them, and Semler was a prototype. So we don't need to worry about that. All we do need to be concerned about is the fact that the issue of the canon is a live one. And when I get into textual criticism, I'm going to try and show you more why that is the case. We've already seen from what we've said about the Maritonian fragment that if you take a 4th century date, then it becomes more and more a church decision, doesn't it? If the 4th century church says, well, these books are canonical, they don't have any authority over the 21st century church, do they? So why can't the 21st century church decide which books are canonical and which books aren't? That's the question, and we need to be aware of that. We'll come back to that when I look at textual criticism, and hopefully I'll show you the dangerous ways that this is all going today. By the way, just to say this, Everett Ferguson does make a clear statement that there was never any council that really ratified and decided the canon. We know the Council of Carthage and so on did say something about it, but it was a done deal by that time. God had decided it centuries earlier. Now there's another issue that I need to come to quickly, and that is this issue of a canon within the canon. And do read F.F. Bruce's chapter on this. I think you'll find it interesting. It is true, we've got to be careful as evangelicals that we treat the New Testament in balance and in its full integrity. After the ascension and the calling of Paul, his writing of the epistles, he's the apostle to the Gentiles, he's written us these great doctrinal documents that we get our central doctrines of the faith from. And we put Paul on a pedestal, really. I mean, we say that doctrine must agree with Paul's writings. Even the general epistles must line up. But you see, we've got to be careful that we don't create a canon, Paul's writings, within the canon of the 27 documents. You see that? That we don't just pick out what we like. We've got to use the whole of the New Testament. How do we deal with this? How do we address this issue? Well, again, we address it like every other issue with a sense of balance, a sense of maturity. First of all, just because 27 documents are the canon of the New Testament doesn't mean they're all exactly equal for today. The Gospels tell us about Jesus and his teachings, and they're invaluable for that. You say, weren't the Gospels written for the church? Chronologically, as far as the time period that they cover, they deal with a time before the start of the church. That being the case, and there being a difference before the crucifixion and after the crucifixion and resurrection, we need to note that difference and note it by comparing the Gospels and their teaching with the post-resurrection documents of the Apostle Paul. Remember, Christ himself picked Paul out, told him what to write. He said, I didn't learn what I learned from men. I didn't get it from men, but I got it from Christ. So that being the case, Paul should be followed. That's where we get our doctrines from. What about the general epistles? Well, the general epistles are more general. For example, James and Hebrews, and some would argue, Fruchtenbaum, for example, 1 Peter, have teaching and a nuance which is more, perhaps more Jewish. James says he writes to the 12 tribes scattered abroad. The epistle to the Hebrews is to the Hebrews, if you say that that's an original title. It certainly evokes a lot of Hebrew and Old Testament connotations. And so this is the reason why the epistles of Paul must take the central place as far as determining the doctrine and the doctrinal bounds of the rest of the New Testament canon. So is there a canon within the canon? No, there isn't a canon that we take out and we say we are just using this and disregarding everything else. But it is true that some canonical books do possess emphasis for the church that some of the others don't. Doctrinally, they are in a more corroborative and supportive role. Read Bruce on that as well. And, you know, there are some things that we need to watch out for. It does annoy me sometimes that dispensationalists mess around with things like the Sermon on the Mount and say, well, this was for then, it's not for today. Well, that's not a very balanced and mature way of looking at Jesus' most profound teaching. But there's hardly anything in the Sermon on the Mount that doesn't line up with what Paul writes in, say, Ephesians 4 and 5, and in 1 Thessalonians 4, and Romans 12, 13, 14, and other places. And we should go and read and take seriously these passages. The New Testament canon, just as the Old Testament canon, is not just for one group of people at one particular time. We've looked at the post-apostolic problems, and there are problems, and I hope that I didn't bore you too much with them. I tried to get through them succinctly and fairly quickly, but they are fairly detailed, and I needed to bring things to your attention. We looked briefly at criteria of canonicity for the post-apostolic church. Now, what I want to do is to move on to this vexed question of the textual criticism of the New Testament. I'm just going to provide an overview, and my reasons for doing this are to show that this has an influence on what we do with the canon and is likely to have a bigger influence on canonical studies as we move forward into the 21st century.